Hello, and welcome to this October episode of the Royal Society's podcast, Our Science. I'm Eleanor Beale.
And I'm Ben Cunningham. We're bringing you highlights from all kinds of Royal Society activities this month, as we've been travelling the country to visit the party conferences, celebrating Black History Month, looking back on 50 years since Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, and asking one of our research fellows, what causes psychosis?
So quite a mix, as you can see. You'll hear more about all of these things in this episode, but first up, we were on our political travels.
September this year was party conference season, and the Royal Society visited the Labour Party in Manchester, the Conservatives in Birmingham, and the Liberal Democrats in Glasgow. We hosted two events at all three conferences, and you can check out our blog posts from all of the events on our science policy blog, In Verba.
Our public fringe events were based on our recent policy report, A Vision for the Future of Science and Maths Education. Some of our colleagues caught up with some of the attendees to find out what they thought of the event and of the report itself.
At the Labour Party fringe event, Lena Munro chatted with the chair of the evening's discussion, Maggie Philbin. She also got the business perspective from EDF Energy and the teacher's perspective from Max Hyde, president of the National Union of Teachers. It was a busy event, so apologies for the background noise on these clips.
So I'm Maggie Philbin. You might know me from Tomorrow's World, but I also head up an organisation called Team Tech, and I've been chairing the discussion tonight. As we've probably heard tonight, I think there was real warmth for the suggestions. One of the things that really sang through in the report was the respect for science and technology teachers, and sort of saying, right, okay, you know, we want to give you more responsibility when it comes to assessing your students' work. We want to treat you like the professionals that you are, and we want you to be part of the science community. I mean, tonight was fabulous because there was so much engagement from the audience. There were so many questions. It was awful to bring it to a stop. And the panel were sort of fantastic, offering really good insights and you know, sort of like reality checks on, you know, what is possible, the things with the barriers that, you know, could perhaps trip up such a you know, a wonderful policy.
Hi, I'm Dave Drury from EDF Energy. I'm the director of learning and development for the UK's branch of EDF Energy. We thought the report was really good. It was a really good blueprint for education and learning, really, for the next 20 years. But fundamentally, more than that, it was part of a, if you like, a business plan for UK PLC. So for UK PLC to be successful and compete in the world market, we have to make sure we have the right skills and capability in our young generations as they move forward.
Hi, I'm Max Hyde. I'm president of the National Union of Teachers, but I'm also a teacher of chemistry and physics for over 37 years. And I'm passionate about encouraging young people to go into STEM subjects. This is a wonderful report. It's very thought-provoking. It is a genuine vision. It's wide-ranging, and it's about education for life. The thing that teachers really, really welcome is the positive tone in which it's written. How wonderful for our achievements to be recognised. How wonderful to feel supported by the entire scientific community. The more that we can work like this, the better the chances of our children, and that's what we all want. The ideas within the report are all evidence-based, and that's a pleasure as well, because so often we've had hastily introduced changes, ill-thought-through curriculum, and terrible unforeseen consequences to the detriment of our children. Science to be taught in this way is inspiring. It opens up horizons, not just for the next test, but for the whole of your life. And isn't that what we all want?
At the Conservative Party conference fringe event, Marie Rogerson caught up with the chair of the Vision Report's working group, Dame Julia Higgins, who gave her impression of the evening's discussion and presentations.
What are your reflections on today's event?
Well, first of all, I thought the five or six presentations were very interesting because they covered a range of things. The schoolgirl we had was terrific, but she's, of course, just the sort of school where you would like a girl to be and where physics and maths are taught extremely well. And the teacher also was from, as he pointed out, the sort of school where they have time to develop things and so forth. With hindsight, it might have been good to have somebody from a more normal state school to balance it, simply because that was the perfect end of education, and it'd be good to have somebody at the other end. Having said that, I think the message about what science and maths education should be came across very well for them. I thought that the minister gave a more broad view than I expected he would give. He was focusing very much on a particular area of roughly primary school education in his speech, but he did talk about more broadly about schools. What somebody in the audience said, why is it culturally okay in this country to say you're no good at maths? And there were one or two points made by speakers, well, people are using maths in their daily lives, but probably they were talking about arithmetic. And I think the point was made that mathematics as an abstract subject is where people get lost, and that's why we need more teachers in the area. I thought we had quite a lot of interesting discussion about teachers, how to support teachers, how to get teachers time to develop the subject and education. We didn't spend an awful lot of time on the curriculum. We did have some good discussion on practicals in schools and the disaster that the science establishment thinks would happen by not examining them. And that allowed some discussion about assessing practicals is possible, but it needs to be developed. And that actually, and this was the point made by the minister, expecting schools to have practicals within their science ought to be just natural. Every school ought to be able to do that. But I was able to point out that that will not happen unless you measure schools in much broader terms than they are currently measured, which is tends to be the number of GCSEs that they pass at grade C.
If all of that's piqued your interest in the future of science and maths education in the UK, don't forget to check out the full report on our website and read the blog posts from all of our conference events.
Back in September, one of our Sir Henry Dale Fellows came to the Royal Society for a Café Scientifique event. His talk was called What Causes Psychosis? So we grabbed him for a quick chat beforehand to see if he could tell us the answer.
Tonight I am going to talk about the epidemiology of psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. I'm an epidemiologist, and I'm interested in understanding more about how our social environment might increase the risk of developing psychotic disorder. And that can be anything from the neighbourhoods that we live in, through to things that happen to us in childhood, through to being of a particular ethnic minority group, or experiencing things like migration. The evidence seems to suggest that where you live might affect your risk of developing a psychotic disorder. We know, for example, that people who are born and brought up in more urban environments have an increased risk of psychotic disorder. What we don't know is whether they've moved into those neighbourhoods over generations to put themselves at increased risk, or whether that's a direct risk factor from the environment itself. We do see an association between the risk of disorder and schizophrenia, as I said, in more deprived environments, sometimes in more unequal environments, and in environments where you tend to see lower concentrations of social cohesion. I'd actually question whether there's been a rise in the diagnosis of psychosis, actually. I think we, from the evidence that we have, the incidence rate of psychotic disorders, and that's quite a narrow clinical definition, seems to have remained quite constant over time. But what has become more common, or more people are more aware of now, is the risk of developing psychotic symptoms quite early in life in teenage years. And there's been a move in the last 10 to 15 years to implement what are called early intervention in psychosis services for young people developing the first episode of psychosis or at risk from doing that. And those services are designed to raise awareness and get people into treatment earlier, because there's good evidence that when you can intervene earlier in someone's psychotic episode, they have better long-term outcomes, whether that's a clinical outcome or a social outcome or an employment outcome. The public perception of psychosis is something we have to think about very carefully, because historically, and perhaps in decades past, schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders have tended to be mislabeled in the press as disorders where people are dangerous to others and so forth. And in fact, there's very little evidence for those kind of misconceptions and stereotypes. What we know is that people who experience psychotic disorder tend to actually have worse outcomes in terms of things like suicide, they're more likely to take their own lives. People are actually likely to live 10 to 15 years less than someone else in the population. And that's not due to things like suicide. That's actually also due to other adversities like physical health problems or worse experiences of care. So there's actually a lot we have to be very careful about when we talk about psychotic disorder and the media perception. And actually what we need to do is make the public aware of psychosis, and it's largely a non-harmful problem but needs urgent attention for the individual suffering from it. My most surprising finding probably relates to something that I will talk about in my talk tonight, and that's the finding that we know that, for example, ethnic minority groups have an increased risk of psychotic disorder, and that's fairly consistent across different countries. However, that risk can be altered by seems to be altered by the proportion of people from your own ethnic background living in your community. So when you live in a more supportive or cohesive community with people from your own ethnic background, we see that the risk for people from those ethnic minority groups tends to be attenuated. And I think that's, well, maybe not surprising. It's something that, to come out of the data so clearly, is something that's really important for us in terms of where we take it next, in terms about thinking about prevention and designing better communities which are more supportive and cohesive. So that was a really wonderful surprise to see that borne out by the data. Why science? Well, I have to say I'm on the fringes of science. I'm a social scientist originally. I did geography as a background and then trained as an epidemiologist. And I've always been interested in the interface of the social with scientific rigor and scientific methodology. So for me, that's where I like to sit and where I like my research to be conducted. I guess the science side of it comes from that rigor, as I've talked about, and it's really... start that part, you can edit that part out. But that's really, for me, the challenge is it's not so much about the passion for science in broad terms per se, it's about the specific passion and challenges that we face in psychiatric epidemiology. We really don't know what causes schizophrenia, and I think that alone is a fascinating thing, which if we can understand more, we can improve population mental health beyond sort of imagination.
If you want to hear more, the full audio of the event is available on our website. And you can also check out future public events we have planned.
What role do literature, science, and policy play in protecting the planet? 50 years since the death of conservationist and writer Rachel Carson, the Society hosted an event to explore this question. We spoke to author John Burnside, scientist John Pickett, and policy expert Kerry Ten Carter to get their views and to discuss Rachel Carson's impact on their own work.
John Burnside, when did you first start to engage with Rachel Carson's work, and what is it for you that's so compelling about it?
Well, I first read Rachel Carson when I was a student because a friend said to me I should read Silent Spring. And then I noticed that she'd written other books. But the same friend said, oh, don't bother with those. Those are just light, nice, friendly, child-friendly books about nature. And Silent Spring is the big hitter. But I thought, well, I'll give them a go because I like Silent Spring. And I think she's a really fine writer about the sea. And the sea trilogy is actually really a masterpiece of literature. In terms of telling science, of course, it is aimed at a very general audience. But children love it, for example. Or children did love it. I think maybe these days children don't love books so much. But I like all of her work, and what I think is important about her isn't actually the science. I mean, looking back to 50 years, the debates on science at that time are different from what they are now anyway. What's really interesting is their emphasis on certain things like wonder, that you should also, when you're dealing with the natural world, you should also be thinking in terms of things like reverence and wonder, terms which were not very popular among the scientific community then, and maybe still not now.
And John Pickett, what impact do you think Rachel Carson's work has had on your own scientific research, or on research more generally?
Well, certainly, in a sense, I'm a product of her writing, because I actually work on alternatives to conventional pesticides. But I think also it's made us realise that, we can't just get through what we want to do by explaining the facts and evidence for those facts. I think if people see a correlation, even if it isn't evidence, but if they see a correlation between a problem and something that's going on, then that can actually build into a head of steam which may or may not be good for the future. And that's the final point that I think we learned, and that is that there is a very low appreciation, I think, of the fact that we all take risks, and we take risks sometimes to allow us to have a healthy life and have a supply of food. And so that really does need to be taken into account. But that's not to excuse some of the extravagances of misuse of pesticides, which has taken place. But it also, at the same time, doesn't really give people the right only through belief to influence policy every time. But I think it's a force for good, and we represent that force continuing now because we're debating the subject.
And so, John, you mentioned policy. So coming now to Kerry, what do you think is ultimately more persuasive in assessing and advocating an environmental policy? Is it the quality of the science or the written word?
I think it's like the good song says, you can't have one without the other. I think they come together. And if you take a look at the legacy of Rachel Carson, I think it was really in popularising science-based, evidence-based views. And policymakers need that evidence-based approach now. They call for it. Of course, it's not the only thing that rests with them. But I think that what Rachel Carson did was strike that balance between having the science, amassing evidence, but doing it in a way that resonated with people, that grabbed them at a time when they were curious, that conveyed it in a fashion that wasn't above their heads, that was very accessible. And she did it with a passion, as John Burnside has mentioned. So I think when you're talking to policymakers, it tends to be a more level and rational playing field. You need to adduce the evidence, but you have to do that in a way that reaches them, because policymakers often don't come from scientific backgrounds. So there's an intermediary role that good writers can play. And of course, now the only medium is not writing. Luckily, there's still an appetite for books. They're very powerful. There's fabulous books, some of which are championed by the Science Prize here at the Royal Society. So that stream of evidence continues to reach policymakers. But we need to be looking at lots of other forms, much briefer forms, oral presentations, multimedia, the internet. We need to reach out to younger people before they become policymakers as well.
And a final question for all of you. What do you believe are going to be the next big environmental issues to hit the spotlight, either coming up through science or through literature, or perhaps both?
Oh, look, I think there's two kinds of new science issues. I think there's the ones that capture people's imagination because they're kind of out there and new and sexy, and people are just engaging with them. And then I think there are the new science issues that practically we've known about for some considerable time, but we haven't resolved. So the big ones are climate change and biodiversity loss and the combination of population growth and consumption patterns and the effects those have on the planet. And by no means have we grappled those scientific issues to the ground, nor have we persuasively conveyed them to policymakers, and nor is the policy world acting on those with the speed that we need. But then at the same time, bubbling up are all new issues. I suppose the really big one that I haven't mentioned already would be water, accessibility, quality, and the sharing of rights, essentially, how water resources are allocated. But then there's all sorts of lovely new subjects that these gentlemen will surely talk about, geoengineering and lots of things to do with neuroscience and marrying artificial intelligence with biological intelligence and all of these things.
I would say that what we need to look at now and what we need to address is actually the politics of the whole thing. The decisions are made by politicians in the end. Well, actually, the decisions are made by people who have the money, and the politicians work for them. And I think it's really important that while most people, there's a few diehards, but most people accept that we're, for example, experiencing climate change and something needs to be done about it, what we do about it is dramatically out of sync with what we know is the problem. We've done really very little about it, very, very little. And governments have done very little. And for reasons that are mostly, in my perhaps cynical view, mostly to do with money. You know, people do stuff that will make money. For example, they will put up endless wind turbines all over the place because wind turbines can make people money, important people money. You know, landowners and big companies. They'll put them in wildland because the people don't want to see them from their houses and cities. So, for example, in a small example here in Shetland, there's 103 wind turbines planned for wildland in Shetland, because that doesn't offend anybody who's influential, and it makes some people a lot of money. But we need to really think much more intelligently about how we address climate change, the kind of steps we take. And most importantly, we need to radically change how we use energy throughout, you know, the so-called first world.
And John, any big environmental issues to add
well,
to the
I think
ones we've
we had
there?
Some very enlightened views there, which I share. I think that I have to point to the big one, which is that we aren't really able to deal with healthy food supply to the growing population of the world under climate change. There are some big gaps in the technology that we have today in what we need to have, and they need to be able to create much more food, but in a sustainable way. And so that sustainable intensification of food production is something that we really can't do at the moment in appropriate dimensions for the needs.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for all your views.
We've got full video of this event on our website, so head to royalsociety.org to hear more about this fascinating woman.
In the United Kingdom, October marked Black History Month, and the Royal Society celebrated with a live Twitter conversation under the hashtag of My Life in Science. Participating in the conversation was Charlotte Armar, biochemist from the Institute of Food Research, and Saif al-Islam, chemist from the University of Bath. We caught up with Charlotte and Saifel after the Twitter conversation to find out how it went and to talk about being a scientist and diversity in science.
Listen out for the live recording of Charlotte and our diversity officer James Wharton when Charlotte replied to a tweet.
Why is it that made you come here and do some tweets today?
I suppose you want that science to exploit the full talent pool out there. So whether it's gender inequality or inequality in terms of race or ethnicity or socioeconomic backgrounds, you're wasting a load of talent. I think if you want to reach their full potential, they might really love doing science and science to a higher level. And I think you want as many people to have the chance to do what they want to do. And if there are barriers in that, then that'd be really sad.
Would you agree with that, Charles?
Yeah, I think so. I think as a child growing up, if I had kind of seen a lot of teachers who were ethnically diverse as scientists, then it may have kind of, I don't know, quickened my entry into science.
So having those diverse role models will definitely help as well, then.
Definitely.
Without doubt, yes.
They can identify, they can see. If I'm as a black woman talking to little black girls, you know, I mean, if they see me in the street, there is no way that they would, possibly there's no way, unless their aunties are scientists, that they would ever look at me and say, oh, she's a scientist, she works in science. But if I can get up on stage with my big hair and my earrings and my whatever, and my flashy nails and say, I actually work in science, this is what I do, they might think, oh, right, okay, you don't work in a supermarket then, or you don't, nothing wrong with working in supermarkets, but, you know.
Yeah, so making people aware of the diverse people in science.
Yeah, you don't have to limit what you can achieve because you don't see other people like you in that area.
Yeah. Which tweet was your favourite tweet?
I think it was a lady who asked me if I would advise my daughter, or you know, if I'd let my daughter have a career in science. And the only way I could answer that was by kind of looking at my life and what science has done for me. And it's given me a career. It's given me the ability to travel, to meet all different types of people, and it's given me independence as well, you know. So, yeah, why would I not want that for any daughter of mine? I think that's...
So you would encourage?
I would.
Did you say that in your reply?
Well, in 140 characters, yeah. Yes.
The biggest problem of being a scientist, was that a question?
Yeah,
oh, yes. Well, no, I think the question was, what do you find most frustrating about your work?
Mm.
So it was more of a frustrating bit. So I just said that there was a growing level of admin paperwork in university departments, which is true. There is a lot more paperwork. So that's the most frustrating thing to deal with. I suppose on the scientific level, the frustrating thing that all of us face is that there's so much to do that we love to do,
yeah.
There's not enough time to do it. Whether it's the research we want to do, the papers we want to write, the conferences we want to attend, or
But for going back to your previous point about recommending it to your daughter,
yes,
it has given you a career, it's given you money, it's given you a chance to travel.
Not much money, by the way. But anyway.
You can live off a bit.
Yeah.
And would you add to that, Sarah?
About, I would always recommend it, yeah. I mean, they always tease me, because they roll up their eyes when I talk about chemical science, chemistry. Whether they'll follow my recommendation, I don't know. But I would recommend it. It wouldn't be a career I would say, oh, don't follow me into science, as some parents would do, you know.
Cycle, you're new to Twitter very recently.
Yes.
So how have you found that experience of social media and science?
So, yeah, I joined last week because of this event today. I'm finding it not what I expected. So I think, like perhaps emails and other things, you can derive what you want to derive from it. So I found it interesting that you could follow interesting news feeds like the BBC and science journals. It's been a good experience so far. And then today, with Charlotte doing the question and answer, which is a big challenge, it was actually quite a bit of fun in the end.
Good, so you're going to continue using it?
I think so, just to please the followers now.
Yeah.
I've got these followers we're proud to. I could say goodbye and good luck and then turn it off.
Okay, so let's retweet that. What is the most frustrating part of your job, Charlotte? What is the most frustrating part of your job?
Not having enough time to do everything.
Well, let's go for that then. Why don't we tell them that? So, and then you can delete that.
Right, okay.
I think what you just said is really good.
You should do the hashtag business.
Not having enough time.
How early then?
Enough time to get...
What do you... most enjoy about your research? Is it fun?
Do you come on there? I can't see
Polly. Have you had a lot of tweets in?
Yeah, we've been busy for the whole hour, actually.
Really?
We're in the last 5 minutes now, but we haven't had a moment to relax at all.
No, it's been really good. I've been quite surprised, actually,
quite
at the number
fun.
Of, you know, because you kind of advertise these things and you think, is really anybody out there? But actually people are out there and they are interested in asking questions. They're interested in engaging, which is quite exciting.
Seifel and Charlotte also featured in the Royal Society films Inspiring Scientist, Diversity in British Science, which you can find on our website. You can also read about the My Life in Science Twitter conversation on Storify.
That's almost it for this episode, but there's just time for me to let you know about some of our literary goings-on at the Society. Every year we run the Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books, which celebrates the best popular science books. The shortlist for 2014 is on our website, and if you can make it to the Royal Society in London on the 10th of November, you can see the winner being announced.
Judging for the Young People's Book Prize has just finished. We let groups of young people from across the UK take the lead in picking the winner. You can see the shortlist for this prize on our website, and the winner will be announced on the 17th of November.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in next month. We'll finish this episode in our usual way by asking Seifel Islam and Charlotte Amar, why science?
Why science? Because it's a beautiful way to unravel mysteries and it's exciting.
Why not science? You know, there's so much out there to know, there's so much out there to find out about.
We both think that science is worth doing.
Yeah.
Or is great to do. So that I think then there should be opportunity for all backgrounds, as I said before, irrespective of gender, race, and what kind of background you're from, should have access or a chance to do science.
That's one of my frustrating things, is that, you know, there are people out there, there's just wasted talent out there. You know, there are people who, you know, they might have had for a microsecond this interest in science, and for some reason it hasn't been kind of seized upon, it hasn't, you know, no one's developed it, and they've lost it, and they've gone into something completely different, or nothing at all, or they're just wasting their lives, and it's like, you know, there's no barrier, there should be no barrier to achieving what you want to achieve, you know, and if it's science, then yeah.
But I think it'd be great for science itself to have that diversity, because actually enriches science, because I think we're just wasting so much talent out there. I mean, not just in science, but in all walks of life. But it would enrich science if we had that greater diversity. Because science has a process that involves that cliche about thinking outside the box, if we had like a narrow background of scientists, I don't think there'd be enough thinking outside the box.
No, different cultures, different influences, different backgrounds, different ways of thinking, different ways of kind of looking at the same question.
So I agree with Charlotte. If I just affected even one or two people from an Asian and black background to think of even considering science, then that'd be fantastic.